Here one sees a direct link to one of the forerunners of Impressionism, and that, of course, is Manet, whom I mentioned just a moment ago. Manet's painting, Luncheon on the Grass, which appeared in 1863, sent shockwaves through art viewing public and through the art establishment of France and then of Europe. People had painted nudes before, but here was a scene of a young naked woman sitting at a picnic surrounded by two fully clothed men out for a typical scene of a picnic, but with this nude in the center. Manet would draw a great deal of criticism for this, but he set the tone for a new approach to both subject matter and presentation. The Impressionists were not didactic. They painted not to teach a lesson, but to proclaim the importance of painting as such. It was, in many respects, not an attempt to capture a public, but to simply to make a statement of what one saw. The Impressionist movement would be followed, of course, by the Expressionists, painting not so much even giving the impression of an object, but rather the painting was the expression of the artist's intellect, art as personal expression. One thinks of Paul Gauguin, or, of course, the works of Vincent van Gogh, the famous Dutch painter, who were painting a mood as much as an object. They would be followed, of course, in the years prior to the outbreak of the First World War by the avant-garde in painting around Europe. The Blue Rider School in Munich in Germany, with the work of Paul Klee or Kandinsky, in which, particularly with Kandinsky, with his very, very abstract paintings, would in fact say that what he was doing was trying to find the graphic expression of a mood, not of an object. All of this work, the trajectory from Manet's paintings in the 1860s and into the 20th century with Klee and Kandinsky on the eve of the First World War, really were a slap at the official art of the period, the academy art of the period. They tended to turn the world upside down, make it less predictable, make it less obvious, less objective, more subjective, all of the sorts of things that seem to be discussed and presented in the work of Darwin and of Freud, and ultimately even of Einstein as well. So, in a curious way, we've been talking for the past three lectures now about challenges to the established European political order, the challenge of socialism, the crisis of liberalism, the attempt on the part of conservative circles to find some sort of alternative political formula. In art, in science, in philosophy, in the same period, one sees a challenge to the comfortable assumptions of bourgeois life that had come to dominate Europe at the end of the 19th century. Much of the 19th century had been fought, as we've seen, between the rising middle classes of Europe and the established forces of order, the conservatives, aristocracy, and so on. By the end of the 19th century, it would be middle-class values, middle-class attitudes, middle-class political assumptions that would dominate the mainstream of European political life. These ideas, these visual representations, these philosophical statements and systems put forward at the end of the 19th century would represent a challenge, not as obvious a challenge, and certainly not one as pressing as the challenge of socialism to the European middle classes, but a challenge to the established bourgeois order of late 19th century Europe. It is that hegemonic position of the European bourgeoisie on the eve of the First World War that we will address in our next lecture.